Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Welcome back to Fighting on Film. We are back from our unplanned one-month hiatus. Firstly, before we begin the show, I'd like to thank all of our listeners, followers, patron supporters, anyone from whatever social media account you follow us on. For supporting us during the unplanned break. I won't go into details now, but I want to thank the FOF faithful for all the messages and well wishes over the last month. It's really given me a lot of solace and just nice to have some friendly faces to talk to during this topsy-turvy time at home. But it's great to be back. Matt, you know, we're back in the saddle, aren't we?
I know. We're America's 103rd best movie review podcast.
Yeah, we get a chartable email every week that shows us in the rankings. We don't really check it half the time, do we? But
how we manage that, I don't know. But what one accolade that
incredible.
Is
incredible. You know, get that on a plaque on the door.
But no, it is good to be back.
Yeah, it's good. It's nice to see you again, mate. Nice to, well, I say see you. I see you a lot anyway, but like, you know, it's nice to be back podcasting. So Matt, you know, I thought I'd kick off the show before we get into the meat of this one. Did you watch any good films while we've been away? It's a loaded question because
good is a debatable question, but yeah, I mean, we both kind of co-watched an interesting Michael Gambon film, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Paths of War, was it?
Paths of War, yeah.
Yeah.
Michael Gambon.
Where he plays LBJ.
LBJ biopic, yeah.
What an audacious casting that was by HBO.
Yeah, with Alec Baldwin.
Sutherland was in there too.
Donald Sutherland, yeah. Lieutenant Dan from Forrest Gump.
Gary Sinise.
That was an interesting movie. Like, I wouldn't say that Gambon is 100% LBJ, but he was giving it a good go. You know,
it was a film that really wanted to be about Robert McNamara, but wasn't. It was odd. It was
It really did become about McNamara halfway through, didn't it? Yeah.
We watched that was a long film because it was obviously an HBO two-parter originally.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, like 2.5 hours.
It was a long one. It was about like 4 a.m. or something.
And we didn't even start the beginning of it. We just channel hopped to it.
No. It was on this morning. I took my little one to playgroup and then I came back and I was like, oh, I'll see what's on Sky Movies and we'll catch something. And it was on. So I watched like the 10 minutes we didn't watch. I didn't miss anything. And then I remember I was with Matt at the time. We watched the Star Trek Next Generation films, didn't we, together?
We did. This is part of Rob's epic journey into becoming a Star Trek fan, which I wholeheartedly condone.
Yeah.
But yeah, we watched First Contact and Insurrection and Nemesis. We watched Nemesis. We watched Insurrection and Nemesis together. You watched First Contact on your own, didn't you?
A little bit
before.
Well, that's a war film in my book, so it's going to be covered.
I agree. I mean, it's the closest Trek gets in the films to a war movie.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
Obviously, DS9 has the actual war in it.
The Dominion War. Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, definitely, we will do a sci-fi month eventually, and First Contact will definitely have to be in there. You know, maybe Aliens, Battlefield, Los Angeles. Well, Battle Los Angeles.
Battleship.
Battleship, yeah.
Got to put one shit one in there, haven't we?
There's a lot, yeah. Yeah, and we watched Under Siege that night, didn't we? That we watched Paths of Glory. We rewatched that. It's a classic. Yep.
It's so good.
It's in a schlocky kind of bad way. It's good.
It's peak 90s action movie.
Yes, definitely.
It's Seagal's best film.
It's not saying purely much.
Purely because Tommy Lee Jones is in it.
Oh, it's great.
Tommy Lee Jones, Gary Busey and Colm Meaney are chewing the scenery, having a great time. And then we just get weird intermittent scenes with Steven Seagal.
Shooting at things. Yeah.
Yeah.
And not running very fast.
Weird weapon handling and
it's
bad
fantastic.
Acting.
It's great. It's fun. Yeah, it's great. I also watched 13 Days, the Cuban Missile Crisis film. Yeah, that was good. Really enjoyed that. I can't remember who it had in it now. Oh, Kevin Costner. Doing a funny Boston accent. Yeah. Really good film.
I feel like they were trying to go with that with the LBJ film. They were trying to get that, nail that level. Was that Oliver Stone, wasn't it, 13 Days?
No, that was, you're thinking JFK.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's in the JFK mold, though. You know, done very well. I enjoyed that movie. Even though you know what's going to happen, you know, the atom bombs don't get fired in the missiles.
You do sort of like forget its history and suspend belief. Yeah. Like, oh shit, I really hope that U2 doesn't go down. Oh fuck. Ah.
They need to stop those Cuban boats. It's gonna, oh god, you know. I really enjoyed it. You know, proper late 90s, early 2000s filmmaking. I just don't feel that. I feel we've lost that somewhere. Anyway, but moving on to this week's film. So to get us back in action, we went to see separately, might add, Civil War, the new A24 film, which just come out this weekend. And obviously from here on in, spoiler alert if you've not seen it, but you know, in typical FOF fashion, we like to bring you the reviews as quickly as we can.
And if you're turning off because it's a spoiler review, I would definitely encourage you to go and see it because it's definitely, I know it's on an IMAX right now, but I saw on a normal screen. I think you did too.
Yeah, I did, yeah. Cineworld.
But it definitely stands up to a cinema viewing rather than streaming at home sort of thing.
I would, unless you've got like a fantastic sound setup. So I think I'll kick off with production, if you don't mind, Matt.
Absolutely. It's A24's biggest ever picture, right?
I know, right? Yeah. So before we get to that, it was directed and written by English Academy Award nominee director-writer Alex Garland. He's famous for writing 28 Days Later and its sequel. He wrote Dread, which is fantastic, by the way. I love that movie. One of the better comic book adaptations for me. And he directed Ex Machina, Men, Annihilation. And he's also reportedly developing an Iraq war film called Warfare that is said to be starring Will Poulter, Cosmo Jarvis, and Michael Gandolfini's... Michael Gandolfini, James Gandolfini's son. So that'll be interesting.
That's exciting.
It looks like might be like a platoon level thing because they're all very like 20, mid-20s, early 20s actors. So keep an eye on that one.
Well, that'd be good.
And Alex Garland told a reporter at the premiere of this film that pairing of California and Texas was in part to obfuscate the politics, but more importantly, that these two states put aside political differences to challenge an unconstitutional fascist and corrupt president who is killing American civilians. He said, "Are you saying that extremist politics would always remain more important than the president of this sort? That sounds crazy to me." So that's interesting. You know, I think the way this movie tackles its war is very, very interesting, but we'll get back to that. So we definitely will. So cinematography is by Rob Hardy, he's an English cinematographer. He worked on Ex Machina, Mission Impossible. I think it was the fourth one. The Book of Clarence and Men, another Garland movie. It's made in association with DNA Films, who are responsible for producing Trainspotting, The Parole Officer, 28 Days Later, along with an investment firm, IPRVC. It's distributed by the acclaimed A24 production company, known for indie hits. Well, they were known for indie films, but they're now getting known for more box office draw. As the years have gone by, they've produced Hereditary, The Iron Claw, Everything Everywhere All at Once. That is so hard to say off the cuff. And the fantastic Uncut Gems, which have all done superbly well critically and commercially.
Resisting the urge to do Uncut Gems. But anyway, yeah, no, I agree. they are producing some really interesting films. And they always have, to be fair.
Of course, you know. If you're a movie person, you know who A24 is.
Yeah. There is a fair number of memes out there with the A24 Chad layout and such. Those up. They're quite funny.
Yeah. You know, if you're into the BFI, you're probably into A24. Yeah. If you know, you know. Anyway, so the film was produced for a budget of $50 million, making it the most expensive A24 film to date, and has stormed the box office, as Matt said, becoming A24's highest grossing opening weekend to date. At the time of recording, it's grossed $2.57 million over the release weekend, and I think the projections are quite healthy. I'd love this one to make a profit, just so we can get more from this world. Mm.
I can't see why it wouldn't be.
Yeah, me neither. No, it's heavily marketed as well, which, you know, lately some films haven't been getting as good marketing as I think they should be.
That's true.
So it's nice to know that it's had a good marketing round. Anyway, it was filmed in Atlanta, Philadelphia, London and Hampton in the US. Mm. London, UK, Hampton, US.
I recognised a couple of places from some of the places where things like The Walking Dead are filmed, because they film a lot in Atlanta because of in terms of like finance, it's a good place to film. Like there's a lot of tax breaks and stuff, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
You know, for production. You know that scene where there's the long road that kind of curves up and they were driving through it, mm-hmm. and goes off road a little bit onto the other side of the carriageway? They have like this. At least like two Walking Dead episodes set in that exact stretch of highway.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. amazing. So the review this week is not a retro review. It's a contemporary review. Very rare we do this. From empire.com. And I've truncated it because some of it explains the plot in a little bit more detail. And kicks off by saying, "This is a gorgeously made film full of shock and awe. War is hell and it's never looked better. We learn tidbits on how the situation deteriorated, that Texas and California, operating under a two-star flag, have joined together as the Western forces, while a Florida alliance has been defeated. Such details largely appear matter-of-factly in the background, and Garland's script is deliberately vague. The reasons for the conflict almost immaterial compared to the conflict itself. By uniting Texas and California, two states traditionally from opposing sides of the political coin, Garland seems to want to move past the usual political binaries and look at the bigger picture. Anyone hoping for a direct commentary on the state of things in 2024 might find this a frustrating act of fence-sitting, a centrist dad in cinematic form. As a political statement, Civil War is provocative and occasionally exasperating as a purely cinematic experience. It's urgent, heart-in-mouth, extraordinary stuff."
So when we first shared the trailer for this on social media, you know, to garner initial reactions, because we were like, oh, okay, this is interesting subject matter.
Yeah.
And we have an American audience as well as a British one.
We do.
I think that's fair to say. And we appreciate everyone.
Hello, everyone across the pond. Shout loud enough.
Welcome to Fighting on Film USA.
one day, you never know. Yee-haw, everyone.
And obviously it's more pressing and more poignant and timely for them. But, you know, I can certainly see why that trailer elicited some, not concern, but some
reactions, shall we say.
Some reactions, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we'll talk about this a little bit later on when we get to the meat of the film. But I think the way that Garland handles things is very deft. I think the way he doesn't lean into context or exposition too heavily is very good. I think the fact that he just puts this on the ground is a very clever way of and delivering the narrative.
You're there at the climax. You're not there at the start as well. So the people involved as well on the ground, I think it's lost a little bit sometimes in the movie, but the people in the ground have already talked about this probably ad nauseum for how many they months know. Or years this has been going on. So they know already. So it does, it's naturalistic in that way. And you are literally thrown in, you know, the Nick Offerman, well, Matt doesn't even get done cast yet, but I've written that. Nick Offerman playing the president. He's practicing this big sort of victory-esque speech at the start. And then you learn about what's happening. Yeah. But I'm like, it's very well done that first little bit. And then they sort of move away from it. They're like, hang on, where's exposition? Come back. You know, but it we'll talk about it more later. But no, that's I think that's a good review. I think it's a fair one. I've seen some different ones here and there, but I think the reaction on the whole has been positive, I think. Mm. Yeah. And then what did you guys think? We've got the first one-word review back. We've been away for a while. So we have Jim Dudacu says current. Ian McKellen goes with impactful. Stephen O'Neill made us laugh by saying, what's it about? And Matt replied saying, it's a civil war. And he was like, with who? It did make a chuckle. The Sophisticats review put, I am out. What the squad machine gunner yells in the final battle. Mm-hmm. Pancho goes with great. Dr. Phil Wolves goes with troubling. Chris Hughes says gripping. Dr. Stephen Marushin goes with spam javelin, which he has connected it. Ian May says intriguing. My boss, Francis, of the operations room, goes with not quite the film the trailer made it look made out. Not quite the film the trailer made it look like, all connected up. So I guess it's one word. That's interesting because I thought the initial trailer, yes, it did look more war filmy, but then I don't know what I was expecting anyway. So I did go into this one a little bit blind.
Yeah, no, well, I did as well. I didn't want to read too much around it. I didn't really read any reviews or any cast interviews or that kind of thing. I didn't read any of the junket stuff. And the trailer does make it look a little bit more like it's an out-and-out action war movie rather than something that's a little bit more cerebral.
Yeah, but then it does have these massive bombastic set pieces.
To the point where you sat like three quarters of the way through thinking, I wonder where they're going with this. And then they go there.
Yeah. It's something this movie gets in spades is scale. So Matt, time for cast.
Yeah, so we are led off by Kirsten Dunst, who plays Lee Smith, a renowned war photographer from, I can't remember the outlet they're with. Is it Reuters? It's Reuters, isn't it?
Reuters, yeah.
And
it'll sound very American.
That's Jesse Plemons, who makes an uncredited appearance as a ultra-nationalist militiaman, according to the credits I found. I assumed when we were watching it, I thought he might have been US Army or perhaps
Western Forces. Well, he's definitely an ultra-nationalist from that scene.
And Plemons is known for Friday Night Lights, Breaking Bad, Battleship, Black Mirror, that one episode with the USS Callisto, which is like a Star Trek parody.
It's getting a sequel, that.
Apparently so, yeah.
Yeah.
Bridge of Spies, American Made, The Irishman, The Power of the Dog, Killers of Flower Moon, and then upcoming he has a series with De Niro which is described as a political thriller called Zero Day, which is I think on Netflix, so that's what he's got coming up. Back to Kirsten Dunst is household name, we all know who she is. You know, she was a very competent child actor, to be honest, has to be said.
Yeah, like
Jumanji, Small Soldiers, a terrible episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
So many Star Trek references in this episode. Oh, my word.
What the fuck, Gates?
Yes. She was in a frequency.
She was in a really interesting movie, TV movie about the Ruby Ridge siege, called The Siege at Ruby Ridge with Randy Quaid.
Wow.
The Virgin Suicides, the Spider-Man movies, Eternal Sunshine, Marie Antoinette, Fargo. Hidden Figures, and then she had an Oscar nom last year for Power of the Dog.
Yeah.
She took some time out. She's married to Plemons and they had kids in like 2018.
Okay.
This is kind of like her
power
comeback.
Couple. I'd never seen that coming, but what a power couple, yeah.
So the she's having a comeback with Power of the Dog and with this, obviously. And then I think Plemons, it's fair to say, he's on an upswing at the moment with Killers of Flower Moon.
People love him.
And Power of the Dog as well.
Yeah.
Mm. No, he's a good actor. I think he's good.
He's fantastic.
It's a very small scene that he's in, but it's a very good one. It's kind of pivotal, I think.
He's in all the trailers as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. Like I said earlier, like 10,000 airsofters are going to buy those red glasses.
They definitely are. Yeah.
And they're probably going to be the least, you know, out there people that do that. Then we've got Wagner Moura, who plays Joel, and he's a journalist from Florida, and he's Lee's colleague at Reuters. He's been in a slew of South American films, including Elite Squad 1 and 2, which is about the Rio military police, and they're quite well-known in Brazil. Elysium in 2013, Sergio in 2020. He's probably best known for his roles in Narcos and Narcos Mexico, where he played Pablo Escobar.
He was fantastic in that, yeah.
I saw him recently in Mr. and Mrs. Smith, where he plays an alternate Smith.
Okay.
And he was very good in that as well, which is, it's not a bad show, that actually. It's kind of fallen away, I think, in terms of
streaming
hype a little bit.
You know,
it's wild, isn't it? I think we'll have to do a bit of a rumination on streaming in general at some point.
I was kind of over it in a way now. Yeah.
There's a lot to talk about in terms of how streaming affects chosen.
It's the thing is, unless you're there day one, you can just feel like these things just pass you by, and then you want to talk about it like 3 months later, and I was like, but that was months ago. We've all seen it.
And then we talk about Star Trek: The Next Generation, which happened 35 years ago.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah.
Like Rob's watching an episode of DS9. I'm like, oh, it's a good one, that one. It's a good one, that one.
Yeah. Oh god, I bought a t-shirt, a Next Generation t-shirt that's as old as me. Christ, that's how long ago.
Literally yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Then we've got Callie Spaney, I think that's how her surname is pronounced, and she plays Jessie Cullen, who's an aspiring young photojournalist who accompanies Lee and Joel on their journey. She's been in Pacific Rim, Uprising, Bad Times at El Royale. Did you ever see Bad Times at the El Royale?
No, I didn't, but I wanted to.
I really rated that film, and not many people
it
saw it.
It seemed Cohen's brothery. That's why I wanted to see it.
It was very atmospheric. It had a great narrative plot to it. It was really interesting. She's probably best known recently for portraying Priscilla Presley in the Priscilla biopic, which came out just this last 6-8 months. And she's about to appear in the Alien Romulus. The upcoming new installment of the Aliens.
It's got a pulse rifle in it. They're back. It's back.
Yeah, it's a proto one too. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Friend of the show, Jonathan Ferguson, was posting about that on his social media. He was very excited to spot that one.
I bet he was.
Then we've got Stephen McKinley Henderson, who is a fabulous actor. He plays Sammy. He's the veteran journalist from what's left of the New York Times, is how Joel describes it. And he's sort of Lee and Joel's mentor. They're very close, but there's a little bit of professional rivalry as well. And the dynamic between them is really good. I think it gets that blend of mentor and colleague and friend.
He adds that like old head.
He does. You know. He knows his shit. He's been there. He's done it.
Mm.
He's had a very long TV, film and theatre career. Lincoln in 2012, Manchester by the Sea, Lady Bird, Wu-Tang, An American in Saga. And he's also been in the recent two Dune movies as well.
Yeah. No, he's a fantastic actor. Been in a ton. Like, really good guy. Really great. Mm. A lot of weight to his performance. It's a really good cast. Are you done or are you not?
No, there's a couple more I'll go over, but I agree. It is a very strong cast. Obviously, we've got Offerman that we mentioned earlier, and he plays the president. Who's become a bit of a dictator, forcing through a third term.
Yeah.
Probably not in the way FDR did, but, you know.
Not a popular one. No.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he's probably best known for being in Miss Congeniality 2, Armed and Fabulous, 2006.
Wow.
The Men Who Stare at Goats, 2009. He was, of course, the iconic Ron from Parks and Rec, yep. which is, I think, the character that everyone will probably
remember
him for, yeah. ironically. He was also at Bad Times at the El Royale. And okay. he has a
You've
role
got shares
in
that movie, mate. You're trying to get
I don't, you know, that's the last mention. If there's another mention, maybe I'm going to get some kickback. anyway, what, 4 years later? Like 6 years later.
It's in the post. It's in the post.
Yeah. Backdating that check. He's got a role coming up in A Complete Unknown, which is a Bob Dylan biopic with Timothy Chalamet.
Oh, yeah, I've seen the stills from that. It looks interesting.
Yeah. I enjoy it. Did you ever see, probably not, I Am Here? Which had like Cate Blanchett as
I've seen clips of it. Yeah.
That was good. It had like various different people playing him. It was an interesting.
Can't wait
movie.
For Timothy to be going. Like, can't wait to hear him do that. see if he gets it.
Let's see if, how deep he can go. then we've got
what a return of the pod.
Yeah, everyone's been waiting for this quality.
They come for the Civil War chat, but they stay for the awful impressions.
Then we've got Nelson Lee as Tony, who's a Hong Kong reporter who's good friends with Lee and Joel. He was in the Blade TV series a while back. He was also in Westworld. Most recently, he's been in Mulan, the Disney live-action remake.
Yep.
Star Wars is Ahsoka as well. He had a role in Ahsoka, which I started watching, got halfway through and kind of like forgot to finish watching that.
I do it for the Star Wars stuff now. I'm not 10 anymore. I don't care. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think the last three movies sullied it so much for me. I was just like, I don't know whether I can invest the time.
I watched The Mandalorian. It's the only thing I'm enjoying that they're doing.
Yeah, I watched that and the other recent one that everyone raved about.
Andor.
Andor, that was it. Yeah. I know there's a second season of that coming. Then we got Sonoya Mizuno, who plays Anya, a British reporter covering the Western forces. She's kind of embedded with them, with their cameraman. And she basically is there for the last act of the film.
Yeah, she's barely in it, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's very focused on that court cast throughout. She was in Ex Machina, Maniac, which was a 2018 Netflix show with, I forget who was in that, but it was very good. Rob's thinking it's coming.
Tip of my tongue because I watched it and I bloody enjoyed it.
Emma Stone and
Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill.
Yeah, good series, Dan.
Once again, everyone's just like, thank God Foff is back. Just such a professional show. she was also in House of the Dragon, which is that show, and Crazy Rich Asians as well.
It's one of the shows of all time.
It certainly is, apparently. And that rounds out the cast, which I think, in general, is very strong. And
very, very
there's some
good.
Very good performances.
Yeah, they all feel real. Like, there's something they get. It's just enough about them to make them work. I'll talk about that more in a minute. I've written something about the Ali Tally.
I think we should get a T-shirt with, I'll talk about that more in a minute on. I've just realised how often we say that, you know.
Well, I'll talk about that more in a minute, and then I never do. So I think without a
Nine
doubt.
Nine times out of ten we do, but sometimes we don't.
Yeah. It's a circle. It's an arc. It all comes back around.
Oh,
so
God.
Let's bring back the triumphant return of the Ali Tally.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's time for Ally Tally on Fighting on Film.
I'm Captain Dale Dye, and you're listening to Fighting on Film.
Matt, the floor is yours. The first Ally Tally of the comeback.
We've got some cool stuff to talk about this week. We got not only weapons, but we got cameras.
Yeah,
and both Rob and I are big fans of combat photography and combat photographers and the history behind them and the work that they've done. So it was really interesting to finally get a film where, not finally, there's been others, but you know,
there's been others, yeah.
A more recent entry into the subgenre, to get photographers, combat photographers, and this film leans heavily into it, and I enjoyed that. So
it's not Jesse, on MacGuffin, is it? It's not treated.
No,
as
it's not. It's not.
It's not a plot device. It's their job. Like they're doing their job. Like that. That's the point of their whole plot is them doing their job.
Yeah, and a lot of reads on what this film is about is a rumination on the, you know, do you become involved in an incident while you're reporting on it? Do you take that photograph? That kind of question, which again, we will talk about that.
How close probably, do you get to
probably
it?
Probably later on. So Jessie is running all film, which is interesting. She's rocking a pair of Nikon cameras. She's running an FE2 and I think an F3, but you only see,
God, if the weapons chat goes over people's heads, this camera chat is going to fucking be
in the stratosphere. I love all cameras. So context for this is I was a photographer, kind of still am, but did a lot of film photography, did a lot of digital and predominantly street photography as well. So it kind of, street photography is the closest you can get to combat photography without people shooting at you, I think.
Well, you know? Depends where you are.
So for me, seeing like film cameras, that was pretty fun.
And I liked
then
it.
Lee's running I think it's a Sony Alpha. And they've put tape over the Sony.
Yeah.
So I don't think they got any sponsorship on the camera side of things.
No, it's not a Sony movie, is it?
No, but Sony, I don't know whether Sony the Sony camera side of things is separated from the Sony movie production side of things.
Something, it might be something really small, you know.
And I think that she has a Leica 35 Lux lens on her camera, which is a very small little compact lens. Then she has a larger telephoto one.
Yeah,
telephoto that she uses try and spot a sniper, which is pretty cool. Do you want to have a little stab at some Ally stuff before we
rock back to me? The cameras are really good. I liked it. Showed like I thought it was interesting that the older journalist in Lee was using the more modern camera, and the younger, the upstart in the girl Jessie, she's using film. I like that sort of contrast in their styles. So I read something in a review. It's about that Jesse's doing it where you're on film and you can't delete that. Whereas Lee can delete the photo she makes. So she's in full control, whereas Lee isn't, Jessie isn't. It was an interesting little thing. But in terms of like, you know, military stuff, there's a massive smattering of just, if you've seen a picture of the American army in the last 10 years, it's in this movie in a way. There's M4s, you know, lads running around in plate carriers, you know, digital camo is quite heavily.
Yeah, you got a Marine Sharp hat and MTP as well.
There's like these, there's a sequence with, you're never sure who they are, because it's one great thing about this movie, you're never quite sure unless they, in the end, where they specifically tell you who is who. You're never sure who you're looking at, who, what side are they on, who, what's their allegiance, and I like that. It adds great scale to the civil war that's going on around the cast. But there's guys in like Hawaiian shirts and plate carriers fighting what could be US forces or could be one of the Western Force faction.
Yeah,
you never know.
I'm assuming that those guys were Florida Federation
I thought they might have just been like, you know, local militia or something, because they were trying to take back like an apartment building. So it, and there was only a few of them. So it's this whole thing, you know, as we've seen with like civil war conflicts, like so many little factions come out of the woodwork and fight their own war. You know, you look at the Spanish Civil War, how many different factions were fighting under the banner of socialism, but they're actually fighting for their own cause. Yeah. You know, we get it here. And I really like that, the way the movie explored that. Then in terms of vehicles, there's an M1 Abrams tank. There's definitely one. It's a one that's been painted green, and you see it a few times, but they edit it well, so it looks like there's way more of them than there is. Yeah. The Chinooks, Humvees, there's a Javelin at one point, which was really cool to see. I think everyone in the Western world knows what Javelin looks now because of Ukraine. But there's a great bit where it's fired into the Lincoln Memorial, which I just didn't think I'd ever see on film, but it's very well done.
The last act of this film is wild.
Bombastic.
And I wondered whether we were going to see anything like that. They could have, if it had been a smaller budget movie, they could have like they got to a certain point and they got stopped, and then news comes through the president's dead, and you know, they could have done it in a completely different way.
You see like a bit of it, you know, like you see like one sequence they could film, but no, I've said it in my final thoughts, but every dollar of this movie is being pushed to its limit, especially in these action sequences. They are up there with some of the best tightly directed firefights I've seen.
Well, if you take those militia dudes, like they're all wearing sort of like, one's wearing like airsoft plate carrier armor type stuff. Some of them are wearing actual plate carriers,
and they got like, you know, around like cargo, like very like sort of tactical cargoes on and things like that.
And then like Hawaiian shirts over the top of that as well, which is kind of like their unit, their sort of like friend or foe
probably
kind of ID. Which is a terrible idea. But they're running like things like Daniel Defense M4s and just U.S. civilian market kind of carbines.
Cool. I like that touch.
That kind of stuff that you would imagine you'd be, you know, very surprised not
like
to see.
Like the guys at the gas station, they've defending the gas station. They've got these like really tricked out like civilian carbines. So I really like that. You know, everyone's bought their like cheap Timu 3-point sling and he's rocking. I really like that. And then, but even down to like the non sort of military factions, you've got there's a very small sequence where you see the presidential security team in their suits. They got the Glocks and the MP5Ks. Like, that's really nice little detail. I really like that. You could have skimped on it. They could have just been armed with M4s and it would have been absolutely fine. But I like the little nod. Even down to like the presidential cars and things, that was really nice.
That was cool. The beast is trying to escape and stuff. That was a very interesting sequence. I liked that sort of depiction of the last stand of Secret Service.
Great. Yeah,
because there's that famous photograph of I can't remember whether I think it was 92 or 93, where there was a possible. Maybe there was going to be a coup in Russia and Yeltsin was going to get deposed, and there's a load of FSB dudes with AKS-74Us and stuff, and they're just in their suits, they're in like in the building waiting and like looking out of a window pensively, and there's all kinds of things where you think about politicians or dictators about to be deposed, and their personal security details are, you know, close.
It's a nice
hand.
Little touch. You know, they're like the last bastion of defense.
And it
for
flips
the president.
It on its head because you know, the US is the, you know, they're the good guys, and the Secret Service are the good guys that defend the commander in chief. You know, they're the daily protection of that.
Well, I mean, they won't get any help from the FBI because they've been disbanded in this alternate reality.
So the fact that he's a dictator and they flipped that, you know, good guy, Secret Service protecting the bastion of democracy on its head
it's a cool
way of doing it. There's a Carl Gustav during the
was cool. I like that.
During the assault on the White House, where one it takes out a Humvee, which is pretty cool. I would not wanted to have been the chaps in that.
Oh, they were nails.
Sort of like defense post.
absolute nails.
Especially when the Abrams turned up. That was always going to be a bad time for them.
And in that sequence as well, I'm going to say it again later, but the sound design of this movie is so good. And I think that's why we're saying, like, please go to the cinema and watch this, because it's deafening. Like, not only did, like, you know, gunshots that would start sequences maybe jump, and, you know, you were feeling every thud, every hit of the guns. Like, when the 50 cals come in and start opening up, it's like this massive thudding, and it was, like, and really cacophony of sound.
When the characters are close to gunfire, it becomes more percussive.
Mm, it's so well done.
Which gives it a more immersive feel to actual, you know, it puts you right in the scene, which I thought was really good.
Really great. I've got something else as well this week, because I know Matt loves it when I talk about clothes reflecting characters.
Let's go.
So I thought that the civilian clothing of the press team really helps define them. So you've got Joel with his, like, graphic t-shirt, skinny jeans, and his, like, beads. I think he had on it, smoking a cigarette. He's got his tash. He's a bit of, like, this rock and roll type, you know, sort of Tim Pagey, you know, this sort of, like, rock and roll heroes of the war journalism era look about him. Then you've got Lena, suede jacket, jeans, all-purpose boots, you know, big camera bag. You know, you feel like this life of work's on her shoulders. Like, she's carrying it all around. And she is in the movie, because you see her having flashbacks to clearly being in maybe Iraq or Afghanistan, and seeing a riot happen in another country that we don't know where it is. And you see it all on screen. It's really well done. And then we've got Sammy in his suit. You know, he's a proper elder statesman type, working for the New York Times, prim and proper guy. And then you've got Jesse in a, like, ankle-knocking slim jeans with, like, New Balance trainers on, and a hoodie. And it shows, like, how, like, she's the new start, but she's like a younger version of Lee. And it's like, you know, later on I'm thinking, well, she'll swap out those New Balances for a pair of all-purpose boots, you know, from go outdoors or whatever, and, you know, she'll develop. But I really liked it. It was subtle and it wasn't in your face, but the more I watched it, I was like, oh yeah, that, you know, that sort of jacket reminds me of something that I forget the woman's name now, but Kate, the war journalist for the BBC for ages, what was her name?
Kate Adie,
yeah, something like she might wear and things like that. And, you know, then later on you've got that press team, the news reporters, and they're in, like, Erdl, hand-me-down Erdl uniforms with their, like, press Kevlar on. It was just really nice, and it's something we don't get a lot of in war movies. We don't see a lot of civilian combat photographers, war photographers depicted. So it was really just nice to see how that was dealt with and how that works in a war zone. I think it was really, really powerful.
Yeah. I also liked how the truck that they're in progressively gets more battered.
Yeah, it's
as
nice.
The trip goes on. It's a good visual
metaphor.
Yeah, there's lots of really cool little things you can pull out of this. There's an interesting scene where Jessie is developing her stuff in the field because she's a film photographer. She's, you know, she talks about carrying the chemical solution in her waistband, so it's body temperature, and then she gets out a developing bag, like, kit, and she, you know, Lee comes over and she's got all of her negatives, so, like, drying, like, pegged onto an old like deck chair.
Yeah.
And that's a cool sequence. I have a couple of issues with it in terms of, like,
I've been hearing about this for days.
Well, we only saw you the other day, but in terms of, you know, that sequence, because it's a nod and an explanation that she can develop film in the field. It is doable, it is possible. But, you know, there's certain things that she doesn't do, and the kind of in the technical side of things, there's a little sort of, like, tube that she pours the solution in and puts the negative in. That's, like, to develop it. She puts the developing fluid in there. And you're supposed to move that around, but she kind of just, like, sets it down and has a 10-minute chat. And that would have probably ruined the photographs.
See, but for me, that section is to show you that subtly that the phone signals are all down.
Yeah, no, that's that yeah. entire scene is just exposition for the characters and to bond Jesse and Lee together and to show some of Jesse's burgeoning work, you know?
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's me for Ali Telly this week.
Me too. Favorite scenes?
Yeah, favorite scenes.
Hello there. Sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
So it's hard to pin for me, but obviously we can't not talk about the scene with Jesse Plemons in, because it's the most... one of the most shocking, like every little, they're almost like a sequence of vignettes. This movie's more like a road movie set.
I've got that
to
as well.
More in an indie road movie, coming of age film. It's a lot going on, but it works. So there's a sequence where Matt mentioned the Hong Kong journalist, and he is meets up with so Joel's mate. Another journalist meets them on the road, and they have this section where he jumps into their car and then Jesse jumps into to the opposite car. So they speed off and then they lose them on the road. They almost crash the van. But then they get back and they notice as they're driving through this little village that the car's empty, like it's left on the side of the road. And then they have this moment where they find where Jesse and the man are. And Joel's mate, and they use the telephoto lens, and it's these three soldiers being led by Jesse Plemons, and they've got like an excavator tipper, and they're like tipping dead bodies into a pit, and Jesse's throwing lime over them, and it's all a bit distressing and mad, you know, that this rogue element, this three guys are just ethnic cleansing on their own. And then it becomes this extended sequence where Plemons' character he's not unnamed. So Plemons' character is talking to them about, you know, what kind of American are you? It's in the trailer. You know, it's probably one of the most affecting lines of the movie. And I think Jesse says she's from Missouri. Lee says she's from Colorado. Joel's from Philly. Is it Philly or Florida?
Florida.
Florida.
And then when the guy that Jesse was with says he's from I think it's Hong Kong, he says, isn't it?
Hong
China.
Kong. Yeah.
Plemons just goes, oh, China, and then shoots him
That's
in the
chest. That's not very American. Yeah, shoots him. And it's so brutal and sort of off the cuff killing and like no thought or rhyme or reason to it. And it's this whole thing of like, it's showing the ambiguity and vagueness of his allegiance and the whole war as a whole, from what we know as an audience. Like,
it's this societal breakdown as well, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's the kind of thing that we've been seeing, you know, from around the world, Africa and Asia and countries where, you know, the rule of law is broken down to the point where it's armed gangs.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're seeing armed gangs in a first world country, which is, you know, the leader of the free world. That's the jarring part of this movie, and especially of this scene.
Yeah. It's very affecting. And then you think that they're all going to get killed, essentially, and Sammy turns up in the van and manages to run over the two Americans that are
Superb driving.
Oh, amazing. You know, great.
Actually manages not to hit anyone that's in his party, but manages to get Plemons and his friend.
He knocks Jesse into the pit, doesn't he?
Someone had to go in the
grave.
Pit.
Yeah.
And someone has to go in the grave pit. That was always going to happen.
Brutal, like, aerial shot of Jesse trying to get out of the pit, and it's just like, at least 50, 60 bodies in there.
Yeah.
And she crawls over them, and it shows the human cost of a war like this. In its own way, and it's this how brutal and murky civil wars are. You know, who's your enemy? You know, just because you come from this state or just because you come from this town, you're my enemy, regardless of who you are as a person. Like, that really hits home the whole, you know, if this was to happen, this is the thing that happens. You know, yes, governments get deposed, yes, regimes might change, but it's the human cost of war every time. that's going to be.
It juxtaposes nicely with the scene in the sort of town that's not really been touched by the war.
Yeah.
More or less bypassed it. They're living a fairly normal life, although there are militia on the roofs, kind of protecting the town. But it juxtaposes really well with that. Another scene that jumps out for that rule of law breakdown is the scene at the gas station where they pull up and Jesse spots a couple of guys hanging in a car wash and described as looters, but I guess they probably just tried to look, trying to get some food or fuel.
Offered the wrong amount of money for gas, perhaps.
Yeah. And I love the fact that, you know, they have this big reveal where they go, it's 300 Canadian dollars.
Yeah.
And that is great because, you know, not only is it, you know, true to form in places where rule of law breaks down, often like gold or dollars or pounds become, you know, the key currency rather than local currency.
Yeah, because there's inflation and things like that.
Yeah. And, you know, it just, the government may have fallen, so government issued currency completely loses its value.
And he has a great line where he says, oh, 300 US gets you a sandwich, we got ham or cheese. It's a great line.
It's great. Yeah. That whole scene's really good. And it just illustrates that's a group of men that are defending what they own.
Yeah.
And yet have seen the rule of law and society is broken down to a point where they can push the boundaries to the fact where they're probably going to kill those dudes.
Even the young lad in the cap, he says, doesn't he, to the to the girl, he says, oh, I knew this guy, I went to school with him.
He was a bit of a dick.
He's not going to talk to me much now, you know. It's like it's all that kind of this horrible, like, oh well, you know, it's a war, isn't it?
It's one of those things that occasionally films hit really well, where it highlights just how close to that kind of situation society can be with the right factors in play.
Everyone's got a mean streak in them deep down, but it's usually society and the way that we work and the way we interact with each other that stops us. And when that breaks down, you know, who knows what people would do? And I think that's the point of the movie, isn't it? At points. But then that's very good. And then obviously, you know, the final assault on DC, as I mentioned earlier, it's so tightly done. You know, every penny of that budget is being spent so well. Really interesting to see street-to-street fighting in a US city. We don't really get that in movies. I think the only time I've ever seen it done in any form of media was Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3, when the Russians invaded New York. That reminded me of that a little bit.
Get a little bit kind of flavour of it in, you know, Battle Los Angeles.
Oh yeah, and of course you do. You
get troops on the ground in that, but it's not the same that's obviously they're fighting aliens. It's not the same at all. But
yeah, and you've got, like, you know, the streets of DC are like piled up with cars where the people try to make roadblocks, and, you know, just handfuls of loyalist troops to the president just taking pot shots at the Western forces who clearly now are like the bigger force.
Because you get introduced to that when you arrive at that camp, and the film layers up the number of Chinooks that it's following. It starts off by following like a little scout helicopter, and then it's a Chinook, and then it's another Chinook, and then it's another. And you're thinking, oh, okay, this is the force that Nick Offerman at the very beginning of the film was issuing a ridiculous propaganda speech saying we're at the crossroads of achieving a brilliant victory.
This victory will go down in like the history books as like one of the greatest military victories ever. And it's like he's clearly
typical
just trying
propaganda
to save face.
Stuff like really outlandish once you understand the context of what's actually happening.
But I like the way that scene did it, where you're at this massive military base, and because you're with the press team, it doesn't matter if they're, because it's obviously a civil war, it's a bit different to a regular conflict where they're really defined sort of different armies. But like, you're never, not in a bad way, but you're never sure, like, oh, are we with the bad guys now? Are we with the good guys now? It's so morally ambiguous, and I really love that. You know, and it's clear that these Western forces have really, like, you know, they're the dominant force, really. The amount of kit they've
got guys in MARPAT, which suggests they're former Marine Corps. You've got, there's a Chinook that has a 7th Cav unit logo on the front of it, like, which is kind of faded.
You know, they've got so many different,
and they've just painted up like a WF on the side of it, and yeah, little visual cues like that are really interesting.
That WF reminded me of the Z on the Russian tanks in Ukraine.
A little bit,
of that. Yeah, I really enjoy that.
A little bit of the Wolverines as well from their dome.
Definitely. I thought we might have seen something a little bit like that, but I'm glad they didn't, because it would have been out of place. So, Matt, some of your favourite bits.
So, I've got one small one and then one more substantial one. I really liked, there's a little sequence where just after we're introduced to Lee, she's in her hotel room and she's just finished uploading a story. And she heads up to her room and she's in the bath relaxing, and she has a bit of a flashback, as you mentioned earlier, it flashes back to some of her previous experiences. But then I thought, when I sort of, as soon as I saw that, I thought of that photograph of Lee Miller in Hitler's bath in Munich.
Yeah, that was really on the nose. Yeah, it was good. I really enjoyed that.
So it's David Sherman's photo of Lee Miller sat in Hitler's bath. And it's kind of like the tiling and the style of bath.
Yeah.
And just the fact that it's the two Lees. Mm. That just jumped out at me. I assume that was...
It's coming out on September the 13th in the UK on Sky Cinemas.
You heard it here
for everyone. Yeah, yeah. Well, press release a couple of days ago, actually.
On the US's 103rd most popular movie... podcast.
Yeah. Well, no, we're lucky. We're in with the Sky people for that one, so hopefully we'll get
hopefully we'll
look.
Be able to
really looking forward to that
review. That I am too. And another of my favorites is I liked the sniper sequence as well. I thought that was pretty good. They arrive at a golf club which has a Winter Wonderland sort of amusement.
Yeah, like a kids thing.
Yeah. like a seasonal fair type thing.
Yeah,
it's midsummer, so it's very jarring, and you've got the music playing as well, which is weird, and there's sort of
it's unsettling,
very unsettling. And there's mannequins strewn around, but there's a dead body in the road, and they know it's a sniper because it's, you know, it's a very precise shot. I think the guy shot in the head, and they drive forward and they immediately take fire, and they drive over the body, which is again very jarring, and they take cover. And then it's a really nice reveal. The camera kind of like pulls back and shows a sniper and spotter laying on the ground next to a diorama. Yeah, diorama.
Next like to Santa's, a diorama. Santa's grotto or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of like a it's like a living room, like a Christmas scene.
Yeah,
and Lee's taking a look through her telephoto lens. Jesse's taking a photograph of the sniper team. And they have this conversation, and Joel's kind of shaken, and he's asking like, "What's going on here? Who are you guys? Who's giving you orders?" And the sniper turns and says to him, "No one's giving us orders. They're trying to kill us."
Yeah,
and that is another one of those little vignettes of those moments where it's war, it's chaotic, there is no real structure. It's two dudes that have been shot at trying to kill the guy that
whoever shot at him.
Yeah. It could be one of theirs. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Like it's a survival sort of situation.
I like it in that scene where the sniper goes like, "Can you all shut the fuck up?" Because he's trying to like get the shot. It's really good.
And Lee's sat underneath a truck, and she's looking at some wildflowers, some bluebells.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's obviously what we haven't mentioned is when Sammy kind of runs over Plemons and his friend, he's wounded mortally on the way out.
Rip-locking.
Exactly. And that is the kind of the turning point where Lee is starting to ruminate more and more and turn inside herself to her.
He has like an existential crisis, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. And looking at that bluebell, she's, you know, she could be thinking 1,000 things, but she's probably thinking, what is the point of all this? Yeah. Why am I lying here under a truck next to these people that are trying to kill each other? And I really like that scene. That was one of my favorites. I also really like the scene where they drive through the forest that's on fire.
Mm-mm.
And I thought that was a really nice visual, because you mentioned it when you came out of the cinema earlier today in a message. You mentioned it as being one of those visual touchstones to coming of age and
yeah, like the whole hand on the window
yeah, exactly. And I really like that, because they're all looking out that window at this amazing landscape with awe. They're all kind of looking really even Sammy's looking out the window with awe, you know.
Yeah, well, he's got a severe blood loss. He's probably delirious at this point.
That's true. Yeah.
But like, the only reason that stuck with me is because it reminded me of a very obscure Family Guy cutaway gag where they're like, "This is brought to you by like hand out of the car on a road movie productions." It reminded me of that because it's very indie movie,
yeah,
like esque, but it works because this is probably Jesse's first big trip, and especially one like this, because we're not sure how she got to, you know, New York from Missouri or whether she was living there or whatever, but it for her it is a road, it's a trip, you know. Yeah. I like the way it does that.
Is a youthful innocence to it, which obviously is, again, flipped right on there. Its head.
Yeah. I think maybe we should go into final thoughts.
I think so. I think we're probably going to meander a bit there as well.
Mm, definitely. Yeah. So I've got it here, and I said it to Matt this afternoon after I came out of the cinema. It's the first thing I said. I was like, the mid-budget war movie is back with aplomb, and long may it reign.
Mm.
Because we don't get these fucking movies anymore. We don't get like Fury was the last one you could have said that was like, was that 50 Fury. 75 billion quid, you know, like this is 50 million, it's A24. They're clearly they must have had some sort of dynamical shift over the last few years. They're going for big budget, going for acclaim, putting money into productions, they're getting big stars on board, and it's working. And this shows that the war movie genre isn't dead. It can be. It doesn't have to be this massive event with some huge cast of A-list stars, you know, recreating a battle from World War II. It can be something as interesting and different as an alternate reality American Civil War movie about photojournalists. Like, it just shows that the movie, the genre itself, and this is one of the reasons we do the fucking show, is the genre itself is so vast, but people don't stop to think. They just think war movie, it'll be guns and it'll be tanks and it'll be
That's it, exactly. The thing about the war movie is it's one of the most versatile genres of film that allows you to tell a whole plethora of stories.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think what this film is doing is it is a rumination on how close society is to this sort of thing, but also it does pose those questions for journalists of, do you take that shot? Do you get involved?
Yeah.
There's a great line from Dunst, this character, where she says, you have to distance yourself. We take the photo so people can ask the question later.
Yes.
We don't get involved in the moment. Mm. And that reoccurs later on when Joel meets the president, you know, because this whole trip is to go and interview the president.
Yeah, that's the point. Yeah.
And the interview is very different to what Joel probably initially thought it would be.
Yeah.
It's at gunpoint and he just basically asks him for a quote, and Nick Offerman just goes, please don't let them kill me. And Joel goes, that'll do. And then they off him.
Yeah. And it's this whole thing of like, I love that arc for Offerman, as small as it was. He starts off and he's like rehearsing his speech, giving it the whole chest out, chin up kind of pompous man, you know, and then at the end he's this cowering wreck clutching onto the White House desk as they're dragging him out. Yeah. And, you know, it's
flavors of Gaddafi and Hussein when they,
Sammy mentions it. He says, you know, these great people usually aren't that when you meet them, you know, they're usually not what you expect. And it's not the ending I thought we'd get. I didn't know.
I honestly didn't think they'd go as big as they did. I mean, let's just talk about that final act. Because
again,
we get a great establishing shot of Apaches flying over the city, firing miniguns into, you know, positions and firing rockets. Then we're on the ground, and you know, there's troops pushing through barricades, and the snipers in windows, a mortar team on a roof firing mortars, and you they do a great pull out where it kind of shows the track of the mortars landing, yeah. And then it zooms back into another sort of team running across a roof, and then we're at the White House and the assault in the White House, and we get that scene with the Carl Gustav and the attack on the Lincoln Memorial as well with the javelin.
Mm.
That 10-15 minutes crams an awful lot in, and then
really does.
What I thought was really interesting is at the very end where they think that the president has left in the Beast and the limo, but it's not. It's a group of his staff,
or
basically, yeah, trying to escape, and it's very reminiscent of the aides escaping in Downfall,
yes.
from Hitler's bunker. You know, where they slink off and try and escape through and, you know, end up being captured or killed. And I also liked the moment where Lee is looking at the Beast that's crashed. And that's a great sequence of its own. Like, it bounces off a Humvee or two, and then a Humvee like careers into it.
And smashes it off an Abrams.
Yeah, they all want that kudos of being the one that captures or kills the president. Yeah. And Lee looks at the Beast and she says, he's not there. He's not in there.
He's not in it.
She kind of has this sixth sense, the clarity of knowing. And I listened to an interview with James Penrose, Lee Miller's son. And he was talking about his mother, and he was saying that she also had this sixth sense of knowing where she should be.
Mm.
And he talks about how everyone was rushing to get to Berlin and be there for the final moment and capture it. But she and Sherman, they decided to go to Munich, and they went to Dachau. And that was, that produced far more important photography than they probably would have gotten in Berlin, where the chaos reigned, you know? So I that was probably not a parallel that the film intended,
I fully
was.
Get it. Yeah.
But it gives that sixth sense that you often read about, you know, combat photographers and war journalists having. Mm. And for me, on a personal level, it was a really interesting confluence of aspects of my life, as, you know, being interested in photography, being a photographer, being a journalist, working in, you know, defense news, and being a historian that finds combat photography and the history of it really fascinating. So it was all really... It was a confluence of so many things that I've found interesting, and it didn't disappoint, which I was really pleased about, because there's been some reviews that came out and they didn't get it. I don't think
they were looking for reasons not to like it.
Yeah. And I don't read reviews before I go into films. I tend to read them afterwards to see what people thought of it.
Yeah. There's nothing worse than reading a review and then having that taint your experience.
Exactly. Exactly. If you're listening to this, hopefully we won't take your appreciation of it when you go and see it. But this is why we give spoiler alerts.
Yeah.
For me, I thought it was really well paced. I thought the cast was very strong. I loved the mise-en-scene in the White House where they walk through. So many rooms are depicted in that. It's great.
Yeah.
You know, there's takeaway stuff strewn across. There's documents. There's burn piles.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah,
there's all sorts of just small things that they've thought of. Mm. And just the way that they progress through the White House is really something as well.
It becomes a little CQB sequence.
It does, really nice. Yeah, and that's really well done. And the Secret Service are giving their all, and there's only like four of them, and they hold off that team for about 5 minutes.
They're railing through those MP5 mics.
That dude with the MP5K that tries to slide across his desk and get cover and gets lit up.
It's a slump of the body as well. It's everything in that is so well done. Like, I've got it here. It's solid, well-made, written war film. And there's so little films dedicated to war journalism. There's that 90s Sarajevo film that comes to mind. But it's like seeing the war from a team of people whose job it is to sit on the sidelines, like not picking a side, is a refreshing take on the genre anyway. Yeah. I think we've mentioned it a few times, but it's as you say, it's the blend of like the road movie, indie coming of age, war film thing, that the editing and the soundtrack choices, like having the sequence with the Hawaiian shirt chaps in their firefight, and their mate gets shot and they're dragging him out, and then they finally take this
little building and they take prisoners, but then that's backdropped to De La Soul.
Kill them as well.
Yeah, but you've got like De La Soul
with a 240.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they absolutely have like brutally murder these men, but it's done to De La Soul. Like, yeah, it's so juxtapositioning and crazy.
The soundtrack is really good, actually.
Really great.
It works. It fits very well.
And I think that's the thing of it. Like, what's going? That's what I took from it anyway. What's going on is so crazy and madcap that any random song in that sequence works, you know, and having a De La Soul rap kind of like 90s feel good rap song, like really, really works. We haven't mentioned it yet, but the stills taken by the press team, they bookmark sequences and you get them as the pictures developed. And that's really great. Like I hope they do it in Lee Miller or they do it in the Don McCullum biopic if that ever gets made, because it's such a great way of sort of showing the vignette of the sequence and the way the images can be so powerful. Really, really great. The only criticism that I have, and it's one that I've seen a few people have, and it's very, very small, but I just want to know more and see more of the conflict that Garland has made, like the why and the how. It's all very vague. You know, I understand why they chose the route. Sorry.
It'd be great if they did like a narrative novel or like a
I'd
graphic
love that
novel or something.
I'd
like
love
that.
I'd read it. You know.
You know, it reminded me in that respect of World War Z. You know, we got the graphic novel before the film, obviously, but the graphic novel gives a lot of context that the film doesn't give.
Yeah, I'd like that. Or even we talked about it before we went on air, but even a mini series like following different press teams throughout the conflict. That would work so well here.
Keep the press journalist, photojournalist element and run with it that way would be a really good way of doing it.
Have a writer, have a digital content creator. All these things that we have now, we haven't thought about really in film terms. Show their job, show them doing it.
Fact-checking team.
Yeah, fact-checking, that'd be fantastic. Like, there's so many ways you can approach this war, and you don't have to show a battle every time, but you can delve into it and explain how it happened and how the world works and why did Texas and Florida secede and why did they go against the president? Like, there's so much going on there. And I just felt, it's my only criticism really, is that I felt we were maybe one or two lines of exposition away from fully understanding the motivation behind the men.
Yeah.
And the women
fighting. Well, they mentioned he's doing a third term and they mentioned he's doing things like airstrikes against US citizens. And they mentioned the fact that he disbanded the FBI. And it's clear that he's become an authoritarian dictator.
Yeah. He's doing what the heck he wants, you know.
But the film doesn't give us any motivation as to why he did that himself or why. No. You know, why they went along that path. And I know that there's a moral and political ambiguity to this. And I'll circle back to this in a moment, but I think there was concern that people on, you know, one end or another of the political spectrum would see this
as... weaponize the movie.
Yeah, almost. Would weaponize the movie and see it as here's what we should do kind of thing.
Yeah, I get it.
But I think the film treads carefully enough.
It does.
It muddies the political spectrum within
that
universe.
It dangles the carrot, and that's what annoyed me. I was the hungry horse, wanted to take a big chomp out of that and learn everything because it's interesting.
Yeah, well, I love well building. I love a rich cinematic, spectrum of
and that's
of
got to be
the universe.
It's got to be the mark of a good movie where you come out of it thinking, I want more from this.
Yeah, that's true.
And hopefully we get another crack at it. You know.
I don't think we'll get a film, but maybe something.
Series, book, podcast, anything.
Yeah.
Come on, Garland, come on.
For me, in terms of criticisms, I thought some of the elements were a little bit predictable. I thought the introduction of the two Chinese journalists only to get killed was very trope-like. And I know that you're going to say, well, it did that to bounce off the trope. And yes, maybe, but in some other cases, definitely. But in that case, no.
Wow, I had my argument told to me and then rebuffed to me.
You know
sentence.
I'm right, though. You know
yeah,
I'm
you
right.
Are. No, you are. You are. Yeah.
And a little bit similar with Jesse's death. That is a classic trope. Which
you mean Sammy? Sorry.
Yeah, sorry, not Jesse, Sammy. That'd be complete turn the film on its head.
It really would have been.
But yeah, it's Sammy's death. It was kind of choreographed from the
it was
minute
highly,
they introduced him, wasn't it?
Highly advertised. Yeah,
like you can't keep up, Jesse. You're too old. Yeah. Like, oh god, yeah. They're gonna kill him. They're gonna make us love him. They're gonna kill him, and they did. So you know, and but
have
it's a good. It,
have an episode
it's a good
of
sequence.
Sammy, like. If they do this series we've pitched, like
early
you know,
war breaking a really
have,
sick story,
have yeah. early war Sammy working in the news New York Times office, like that'd be great. You know, all these reports coming through, what's happening? You know,
yeah.
See, this is the mark of a good film where you want more, and I think
no, I agree.
Yeah,
I like I said, it's really well directed. It's very well paced. The writing is good. The performances were really solid. It kind of feels to me that it's in that vein of It Happened Here, which we've covered on the pod.
Yes, very much so.
Children of Men, a little bit of Red Dawn.
Mm.
But then again, as you said earlier, and as I said when I came out of it, it's kind of road movie, indie movie, war movie.
Yeah.
It's all political, like journalism intrigue movie, a little bit, but not much.
Yeah.
There's little bits kind of come together.
There's kernels in there, isn't there? You know, no, I really enjoyed it, and we thought, you know, we had plans that what we were going to come back with, and then we looked at the date and we thought, hang on a minute, there's a big war movie coming out, we better cover it. In classic Foff style,
I'd expect nothing less from America's 103rd best movie review podcast.
Yeah. So no, really, thanks everyone for listening. Yeah, it's good to be back. We're going to be back on the saddle with some more war movie reviews coming to you soon. We'll finally get our final Masters of the Air episode out.
We will, yes.
Because my life took a massive turn the week that was meant to, that literally the day it was meant to air. So we couldn't get it out. So we've got all your thoughts and all your takes on it. Ready to go for that episode. Then we're going to do a Last Stand special and talk about some of our favourite Last Stand movies. And then we've got a few guests lined up, ready to come on when we get them on. And yet again, thanks for sticking with Foff over this month when we were off. And we hope you enjoy listening again, because we love it when you love us. So thanks for listening, everyone. And we'll catch you next week.
Much more to come. Thanks, guys.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.